This is Everything is Workable, a podcast that examines how every experience, every situation, every moment is totally workable with the right tools and understanding. I'm your host, Caitlin Hatch, creative polymath and dedicated consumer of wisdom. In this season, I'm speaking with other people about their approach to life and practice. This episode is with Lynn Langille, one of my dearest friends and a great source of wisdom and reflection. In this episode, she shares the profound statement, "If you don't take care of the source of everything you want to give, you will have nothing to give." This insight comes from her dedicated practice of cultivating mindfulness, kindness, and curiosity, three tools she describes as intrinsically linked. Each informs the other and supports her in her daily life, from relationships with others to the relationships she has with herself and her experience of chronic pain. As ever, if you enjoy this episode or any episode of Everything is Workable, you can support it by sharing the link, as well as by visiting CaitlinSCHatch.com and leaving a tip. And now, on to my interview with Lynn. So thank you for taking time to do this.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
And to begin, my usual question, which you are familiar with, is if you could give sort of a summary, if you will, of your practice and approach to life.
I thought long and hard about this because it's not something, it's going to take me a minute to sort of get into a flow. So my practice is something that constantly evolves. It's something that I've only become aware of recently in the last few years, even though I've obviously been practicing much longer than that. My practice is woven into everything. It is my conscientious need to put kindness before everything. That's sort of my internal mantra. Whenever I'm watching the news, whenever I'm dealing with people, when I'm in a new situation, when I'm observing someone else's situation, my thought is always kindness. If we are kind first, then everything else often falls away. There's no room for harassment or discrimination. There's no room for ignorance or bigotry. There's no room for racism. There's no room for colonialism. There's no room for a whole lot of things if you're simply being kind. And I find that my practice has become about getting to the root of what kindness is. Mm. And you, do you know what I mean? Like it's how do I truly be empathetic to someone? How do I really go out of my way to understand their situation? There's lots of fantastic, inspiring memes floating around. And I like a lot of the thought behind them when they say things like, everyone is on a journey that you know nothing about. So, you know, don't make presumptions is the message, right? A lot of different messaging talks about the idea that you've not walked in that person's shoes. You couldn't possibly know everything they're feeling, doing, experienced. And that's so true. We forget. I guess a better way to put it is we become siloed. We become so focused on our experience that we forget everybody else has an experience and it's not like ours. Even if it's similar, it's still not like ours. So we couldn't possibly know. So my practice is about kindness first and then willingness on my part. The one thing that I'm so grateful for that has come to me with age is this willingness to just be curious. I want to be curious about people's lives. I want to be curious about their experiences. I want to be curious about our interconnectedness. I love being outside and I love being with people all in different measure. And I find when I'm outside walking, I'm studying the animals wherever I am, whatever wildlife is there, even if it's just insects, and the plant life and the terrain, and thinking, how is this all connected? What made the ground form like this? What happened over however many, you know, hundreds of years to make the climate like this? What ecosystem exists here? When, you know, watching the animals, especially, and I find watching the smaller animals far more interesting, is you have to wonder, like, what's motivating you? What instinct is driving you to do what you're doing? Are you foraging? Are you communicating? What are you communicating? One of my favorite things to do in the morning is open my bedroom window wide and just listen to all the different bird calls. First, I like to test how many I can identify, but then I like to try and imagine, what are they saying to each other? What are the messages? What are they communicating? If I could decipher their language, what would I learn? And so that curiosity drives me to want to know more instead of closing my mind and making decisions. So that, I mean, that to me, that's my practice, because it motivates everything else I do intrinsically. Mm-hmm. If I'm trying to be kind and if I'm trying to be curious, then that means that I'm growing and that I'm doing no harm.
Would you say that you have any kind of spiritual background influence around your practice, or is it something that has evolved for yourself through, like, was there any kind of influence to it, or is it just something that has happened as it's happened?
There, it's interesting. That's a good question. There's a there's a negative influence that sort of, what's the word, spawned or birthed it. Through family and through youth, I was involved in an organized religion. I will loosely call it that. Whenever I talk about it otherwise, I call it a cult, because that's what it is, where their goal was control and submission. So they controlled what you wore, the people you associated with. They controlled what you were allowed to read, the content of everything you were exposed to, your associations. They controlled who you were allowed to be friends with and you weren't. And this was a religion that my extended family was involved in. And so that bled over to my parents, who were not super active. But then in my young adulthood, I had a number of traumatic things happen where I suddenly was just looking for community. I was looking for a place to belong and a safe place. And my family pushed me towards here. Here's instant community. You know, there's organization and congregations, etc. So I'm like, all right. I didn't have a good sense of self, so I dove in. Spent a decade lost in that cult. And so when I woke up, as I woke up, so it happened over a few years, because I never stopped questioning. Like, but why? You know, always that in your back of your mind, but why can't I do this? And why am I not allowed to question this, but he is? And all of these things. It made me really appreciate the need to connect, because they disconnected as much as possible. And so as I freed myself and left, it was like, in the literal sense of the word, it was like being reborn, because all of a sudden everything was new. Nothing had barriers. And so it drove me to want to understand all of the things that I was told were going to hurt me. I wanted to understand every other religion and spirituality out there, because they were forbidden before. Mm. I wanted to understand every type of media out there, even the really crappy stuff, because it was forbidden. Their need to limit everything that I was exposed to actually spawned my desire of curiosity. Mm-hmm. So that launched it. And then I was incredibly fortunate when I found my social community, so my queer community, that I got to connect to some really amazing souls that were on similar journeys, that were curious about the world, that were seeking to understand, that were trying to find a better way to function. Because often, if you were to just follow the general example of our North American society, so mm-hmm. what you see in the media, sort of what the least engaged people teach each other, it's not a nice way to live. It's a really shallow, kind of empty way to live. And I was super fortunate that I got to connect with souls that were looking for more and better. And so I learned from them, you know, and shameless plug, you were one of those people, right?
I know. I was saying, when I did the interview, earlier this season with Nicole, and I was saying, you know, you're one of two total spiritual friends that I have. It's like, yeah, basically absolutely. You and Nicole are like my spiritual soulmates. So, okay. I've got two different questions really that have come out of this.
Okay.
And One is, I think I'm going to put kindness to the side for now, but we'll come back to kindness because I think that's something we can really dig into. So for now, I think let's just talk about the difference between spirituality and religion.
Okay.
Because I think that's a big sticking point for a lot of people.
Yeah. And it'll hinge on how you identify both of those words and those things for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
It's super interesting because for me, I identify religion. So if someone uses the word religion, my first thought is sort of recognized, organized religion, the way it's viewed across the world. So there's ideology that's shared. There's dogma that is distributed. There is the need for common identification, recognition that I belong to this group. We practice our faith together-ish. We congregate together, etc. Do you know what I mean? Like, so when I think religion, that's what I think of, is what the world sort of calls organized religion. Now, many religious people would say that that's their spirituality. For me, spirituality is my connection to bigger.
Mm-hmm.
Spirituality is my place on this planet. Mm-hmm. Spirituality is my responsibility to do no harm. And spirituality is how, that's the wrong way to say it. Spirituality is what motivates me in what I do. For example, we take example at work where I'm a trainer and say I have a class of brand new people that have just started with us and I need to train them. My spirituality enables me to be patient with them, to take my time, to be genuinely interested in their success. Like all of those things, those, you know, quote unquote soft skills that the corporate world talks about. Well, that's my spirituality because it's how you interact with other living things, right? The mm-hmm. fact that I don't step on insects is my spirituality. The fact that I feel bad if I have a plant fail and eventually it returns to the ground and becomes vegetation that breaks down. Do you know what I mean? Like I think in these cycles of, I'm sad I couldn't keep that plant alive, where how many people would care about a plant, right? So yeah, my view is a little unique, but that's how I see it.
Yeah. So I think that one of the issues that I hear a lot from people who identify in a religious way is that when they hear someone saying I'm spiritual but not religious, they're hearing someone say that spirituality is not part of religion. And that's not true because like exactly what you said, right? Because spirituality is your human interconnectedness and that's happening in a religion.
Right? Absolutely.
But there's definitely ways that religions, and again, this is also more of a reflection of how human they are, is how a religion itself isn't necessarily bad or wrong or or hateful, but it's the way that people can use it to, like you said, like to control, to manipulate, to establish themselves in a situation of power. I mean, you just have to look at the history of Britain, basically, and be like, wow, yeah, there's a lot of politics.
Yeah.
Religion was just a lot of politics. So I like that sort of looking at how sort of religions, and I think I take a very similar approach. The religion is sort of the structure around spirituality that can be built around spirituality, but you can have spirituality without the structure of an organized or specific religion.
Exactly.
And interestingly, so as a Buddhist, I was always really resistant to refer to myself as being religious. And so like if there was that tick box where they're like, what's your religion? I wouldn't tick Buddhist because it's like, well, I don't think of it as a religion exactly. But again, a lot of that was because of my influence of growing up in a very Judeo-Christian influenced society, right? We're living in Canada. The idea of religion is based on thinking about theistic religions. But when you're thinking about something like Buddhism or any of the earth-based traditions or the things like, I'm going to get the names wrong, actually. I probably shouldn't even try to say them. Like Orisha, as an example. So you have these other religions where you might even have some sort of god or deity or anything, but it's not about god or deity worship. It's about self reflection and self-actualization and all of that. And there are some religious aspects to that. So now I heartily identify as religious, and I am quite religious. I realize I do things as a Buddhist that I'll encounter other people who might be Buddhists, and like, I'll be like, oh yeah, I was doing prostrations. Like, why are you doing prostrations? Why would you do that? So I think it's interesting because within religious context, sort of the structure that you put around a thing can inform that spiritual practice and has that back and forth. And so in a roundabout way, what I'm coming to is sort of asking you about what does the structure look like for you, whether you call it religious or not, around your practice of kindness specifically?
It's funny because my initial answer, like my instinctual answer, is to say I don't have a structure, except that of course I do, because then it wouldn't exist if I didn't. I find that the structure of my practice is largely mental, that I've created these things that I do in my head all the time. So I've created, to give you an example, I've created this sort of background check-in system in my head. So whenever I speak to someone, or for that matter, whenever I'm thinking thoughts about someone, because you know how, I'll give you an example from yesterday, actually. We were out at an art gala for our daughter, and so many, many people. And I find that I've inherited from years of others around me this critical, sarcastic eye when I people watch, where I won't judge you on what you do, but I'll judge you on what you're wearing, which is terrible, because I am certainly not unworthy of that judgment. And I found that, so I've created this whole dialogue in my head where if I catch myself looking at someone and going, oh, you shouldn't wear that, or oh, do you know what I mean? Those mm-hmm. thoughts, the messages that media inundates us with, I've created it's funny, I'm having trouble articulating what it is, but I've created this dialogue in my head that immediately stops that mm-hmm. and corrects it. So my first thing I do to myself is, why do you care? Mm-hmm. And then the second thing is, what's wrong with what they're wearing? Like, mm-hmm. why don't they get to express themselves any way they want?
Yeah.
Why can't, do you know what I mean? And I'm trying to remove actively all of the shame that society shoves on us, because we're taught to be ashamed of our bodies. We're taught to be ashamed of our status. We're taught to be ashamed of our lack of knowledge or the knowledge. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. We constantly have shame heaped on us for being not enough, too much, less, et cetera.
Yeah.
And so I've created this active dialogue in my head that I try and keep all the time, that as soon as I catch myself building on those messages or supporting that crap, I correct it. I stop it right away. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, chide myself a little bit going, no. If that were you, right? Mm-hmm. So that's part of my structure, is that constant self, I don't want to say correction, because it's more than that. It's almost like I'm trying to keep myself on a very specific path. Mm-hmm. And when I find that I'm straying from it, I get back on it.
I think it's, well, you ask questions, which I think is a really interesting one, because it's like a gentle way. Like you're like, I'm going to apply some curiosity to the situation. Why am I making this judgment?
Yeah. Yeah. Like really, what is wrong with those shoes, with that dress? Like, really, what is it that's bugging you?
Oh, why do I care?
Yeah. Right.
Why does it matter?
And then I know another structure that I have, and again, this is very internal, is trying to make what I call the next connection. Mm-hmm. So when I'm looking at things, so when I'm outside tending to the birds, so I have many bird feeders and a big bird bath, and I really enjoy encouraging urban wildlife to come and feel sustained and feel safe in our area. And I find that I make myself slow down and study everything. And I do it all the time. Sometimes to the annoyance of my wife or whoever's with me, because something will get my attention. And they're like, they have a purpose. They're like, we're walking. And I'm like, okay, but why can't we stop for a minute? It's interesting. This is, your question is making me think of examples of this. And I realize I'm constantly sharing my practice with people. So we were visiting friends out in Burnaby. And they were very excited. They're wonderful people. They were very excited to take us for this walk through one of the wooded areas that's there. It's absolutely gorgeous. And as we're walking along, I just do what I do. I stop and examine things and study things and touch things. And so I'd stopped at a particular tree that had the most amazing moss you've ever seen. And I was touching it. And Lisa comes back and she's like, what are you doing? And I'm like, touch the moss. Like, just feel it. And she looked at me and she's like, why? And I'm like, just feel it. So she reaches over and she touches the moss. I'm like, now close your eyes and just feel it. And so she did, because she trusted me. And she's like, she connected to it. She suddenly talked about how it felt. There was all these things that she'd walked right past that suddenly she was connected to. And I just do that without thinking, which is why a lot of people don't walk with me.
That's why I like walking with you.
Right? Like, come do that.
Let's spend 2 hours wandering around on a gravel beach.
Right? Absolutely. Oh, yes. Anyway, and what was so interesting was a few months later when we were chatting, she was going on and on about how now through spring, she walks around and very gently touches all the different buds, all the different blooms, all of the leaves on flowers, all of the things. And she said that it's changed the way she looks at things. Because now she's thinking, what does that feel like? Can it feel me touching it? So she's thinking on a different level than she ever had before when she was just purposefully walking. She's still getting her walk. And when she needs to, like, you know, have a good pace, she goes and does that. But yeah, I guess that's part of my structure. My structure is keeping myself in line, and my structure is sharing and exposing everyone else to the curiosity of everything around us. We ignore so much and we miss so much.
I think it's interesting how when you pay attention in that way, and this is something that I've got through my Buddhist practice, and this is another lovely parallel and why I love doing this show, because the way that you talk about your practice is exactly what mine is like. And I came to my practice and developed a structure around it because of Buddhism, because that worked for me. And this is why I love it, because I will encounter people who get, you know, you get fundamentalism everywhere. And to be honest, if you're a fundamentalist and a Buddhist, you're not really a Buddhist, but it's kind of like kind of counter to Buddhism. But you still get that, right? And I will talk to people who say, I don't think someone can have enlightenment without Buddhism. And I'm like, well, then you're not, you know, you need to think a little bit more and a little bit differently, because we can all cultivate mindfulness in different ways. And that's what you're talking about, is a practice of mindfulness. How do you find that interplay of curiosity and being present informs your practice of being kind?
It's interesting, because the first thing I do as you say that is I draw the picture in my mind of those three things connected together. And what I think about most often is my connection to our small world, so insects. Mm-hmm. We have very sandy ground where we live, so we always have this fabulous influx of ants. Now, not very many people would use the word fabulous when they're talking about ants all over their yard, all over their sidewalk, etc. But what's so fascinating to me is their resiliency and their strength. And they hibernate through the coldest, awfulest, terriblest weather. And then they know when to wake back up. They know when to become active again. And they're active just like that. Like, they're not there, and the next day they're there, and there's these wee mounds of dirt. And I think of the bees that I watch that come. I now have like this regular circuit of insects that come to the bird bath for water, because it's not just for the birds. The squirrels drink there, the insects drink there, etc. And I'm so careful when they approach. If I'm out there, I'll get very still so that I don't spook them, so that I can watch. And so this story has a point, I promise. Mm. So it's been interesting because many of the bees, and shamefully, it's on my list. I don't actually understand their full life cycle, so I don't know if I'm getting the same bees or it's all new bees every year, but many of the bees, when they come, understand that it's safe. And that's a whole other conversation about energy, et cetera. But they know that they're safe. And so I can have my face lowered right to the bird bath. And they'll come down and get on the edge and they'll drink. And you know what I get to see? Is they have the most fascinating tube for a mouth that folds under what we would think of as our chin. Mm-hmm. And it flips out and they can suck up the water. And then they spend a little time grooming, cleaning, whatever you want to call it. And they move around and they test out their wings. And the only reason I know all of those things and have seen the most tiny aspects of this amazing little body is because I was curious and because I was kind. Mm. I was not fearful. I didn't feel the need to be away from it. Oh, what if it stings me? I didn't feel the need to be cruel. And you don't belong in my space, SWAT, right? I was kind because we both are living beings and we belong in this space. And I was curious, which enabled me to get down there and take the moment and watch. And now I've seen the most incredible parts of this tiny wee body. And to me, you just expound on that, right? Mm-hmm. So if I am kind to another person, and I'm curious about what's your story, what's your history, what's your experience, how is it for you right now? It's a question I ask myself in my head right now, or not right now, all the time, is when I'm meeting another living thing, the first question in my mind is, how is it for you? How is it for you right now? So that I'm inviting them to share as opposed to deciding for them what the current situation is like. And again, that's the part of being present. So when you asked me those three things connected, I'm like, yeah, they're absolutely intrinsic of each other. Because I want to be right there in the moment with them, it enables my curiosity, but my curiosity makes me want to be in the moment. And my kindness, you know, inspires all of that. And now, of course, that I've told the story and I've completed the picture in my head, I'm not confident I actually answered your question.
You did. I think that definitely answered the question. I was actually thinking, it made me think of a quote I recently heard, which I'm not going to remember directly, but I think it was from Mary Howe. And it's from one of her poems, I believe, where she says something about, why do I value the life of a mosquito so little? It was like that sort of reflection of like, the way that we rank and value life and what it can teach us. And I think insects are such an interesting one because you're right. Like the point of view of an ant, like people think that ants are a nuisance. And I remember as a kid, and I recoil to think of it now, when there were lots of ants and my dad would be like, okay, we need to get rid of the ants. And we'd go boil lots and lots of water and we just pour boiling water all over them. And the more I think about it, the more horrific that seems to me that we ever did that. And I was like, I can't believe I ever did that. And especially like ants are so fascinating. I mean, they're like a single organism, the way they operate. And it's amazing. And they're all like, there's so many different kinds. and bees, like you're saying about a life cycle of a bee. Well, it depends on the bee. Because there's honeybees and there's bumblebees and there's solitary bees and and that whole appreciation and I have definitely come to realize more and more the older I've gotten that the level of paying attention and knowing these things is not something that a lot of people do. It's actually not that common.
Yeah.
And so being able to tell the difference between bees, being able to tell just the difference between a bee or a wasp.
Yeah.
And then another thing, like wasps, I had an amazing similar sort of experience of kindness watching, having it modeled. I went and saw Pema Chodron give a talk. I don't think I can do a single episode without mentioning her. And a wasp, middle of the talk, a wasp flew in and she goes, oh, hello. Oh, it's a wasp. And it's on my nose because it lands on her nose. And Everyone's kind of giggling along with her, and there's a bit of nervousness. And she's like, you know, every time something like this happens, I always wonder who that was. And then it lands in her hand, and she's like, okay, however, sweetheart, if you sting me, it's not going to be funny. And then eventually it flies away. And then eventually someone comes out, and they've realized it's gone into the water, into her water bucket. And so they take away the water. The very next day, I was sitting outside, and a wasp flew up. And we were in silence, and there was a woman next to me, and she just pointed to it. And I was holding a cup of tea, and it flew, and it landed on top of the tea. And then it started to crawl around the side, and it crawled along my hands. And I didn't do what I usually do with wasps, which is stand up and freak out and be like, oh my God, a wasp! I was just really calmly watching it. And this woman next to me was really calmly watching it. And we were just having this moment, just letting the wasp be. And then it was weird because another woman came up and she freaked out and she was like, oh my God, wasp. So it was like, we were all in that room. We all watched Pema have this interaction with the wasp and it affected us differently. And here were two of us where we were like, right, we're just going to let the wasp be because it's just doing its thing. It's
yeah.
Just curious. It's checking things out. It's seeing yeah. if there's any food around, you know, it's just being a wasp. It's not out to get you.
Yeah.
Okay. So the show is about the workability of life, and obviously you've got some really good tools for that. And I want to ask you something a little bit more specific then, although you have given some wonderful examples, because you live with varying degrees of chronic pain.
Yes.
And I think that there's one of those things like people can say, oh yeah, I'm all about being kind. And then there's always that exception. There's always that point at which people are like, well, to a point. And I think when you're dealing with pain, that can be something where, like, it can go either way. Like, some people can handle it, and some people can grow through it and live with it, and some people really, really can't. So how would you say that this approach of curiosity and kindness and willingness, is that how you put it?
Yeah.
Influences... I guess it's a two-way street, right? Like, how does it influence the way that you manage pain? And how much do you think having chronic pain has influenced the development of it?
It's interesting. I'll share my first thought, and then we'll get to probably what I really think.
Hey, Zen says first thought, best thought, so.
Right? yeah. So my first thought is that my practice has not enabled me to deal with the pain in a conscious way. And then again, while I'm talking about this, I'm sort of evaluating if that's actually true, because my line of thought is the pain came first to my consciousness. So I believe we're all practicing to various levels. And it's when we learn to identify that we're practicing that it changes. So the pain was, I was conscious of the pain long before I was conscious of practice. And dealing with the pain for me is largely resignation, and not in the sense of defeat. It's the trouble with English is that we will alter the true definition of a word by common usage in a tense. Do you know what I mean? Or so anyways, resignation for me helps me deal with the pain because I can't change it. And so it's very much, I can't change it. So why am I going to give it power? I have to recognize the limitations it imposes, but I can't change it. I can't make it go away. So work with it. Which now, of course, that I'm saying it out loud, I suppose is part of that practice of curiosity, right? It's like, okay, you're here. What are we going to do?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the pain influencing my practice, so the other way, it really reminds me that you can't possibly know anybody's challenges. Because chronic pain almost always exists invisibly, mm-hmm. right? There's no visible injury. There's no sign to the outside world that you have something that's debilitating you. People just don't know. So they make presumptions and they treat you like what they see, right? Mm-hmm. We're We're taught to be far too surface visual, and we're taught to stay out of our heads, and you see this, so therefore make these decisions, which is such crap, because you can never see everything. And so it reminds me, because people can't see my pain, they can't see when I'm having a really bad pain day, they can't see when all I want to do is curl up in the fetal position and cry. It reminds me to be that way with others. It reminds me to always presume there's something significant that I don't know and that I'm not aware of. Mm-hmm. And so it gives me that extra length, I suppose, of patience and curiosity with folks. Because you don't know what you don't know. Mm. And what you don't know tends to be valuable.
Yeah, this is true. What about the kindness aspect of it? Like, how do you direct kindness towards yourself? Because like when you're describing watching insects, right, you're talking about sort of making space for them to do their thing. So how do you make that space for yourself to do the thing when you are in chronic pain?
I learned how to apply kindness to myself after I met my wife. That was something I didn't learn on my own. I learned that from her example. I come from a history of familial abuse, and then my first marriage was very, very abusive. And I didn't understand how to honor myself in any way. I didn't value anything about myself. And meeting Brianne changed that, because she was constantly showing me how to value me. And not in an ideological way of, or sorry, that's the wrong word. Not in a way where she idolized me, mm-hmm. but in a way of, like, the more we knew each other and the more we trusted, then it was easy to confide that here's how I'm feeling, here's what's really going on with me. And her reaction would be, okay, so lay down or stop or take, like, do you know what I mean? She would... She would give you the logical response where if I was aware of somebody else's pain at my own level, mm-hmm. I would go into caregiver mode, right? Mm-hmm. I would be like, how do I care for you? How do I support you? She's like, you need to do that for you. Mm-hmm. So that's how I learned the kindness to myself. And she showed me that it was okay. And I eventually accepted that it was okay. Because those are two very different things.
I know. I'm working on the accepting that it's okay, but I say I have the exact same relationship with my wife.
Right? and it enables me to then also share that lesson. Mm-hmm. Because it was very easy for me to teach kindness externally, right? Very easy for me to exemplify, here's how you be kind to others, and sort of chide and correct people that were being all judgy or uncaring. But now I can actually say, you need to look after you. Mm-hmm. You know, if you don't take care of the source of everything you want to give, you will have nothing to give.
That's, yeah.
Yeah.
Profound.
Pain sucks.
It does. Well, I guess then we can just move on to the last question at this point. What support or guidance would you like to offer to listeners? Specific resources that you think are good, or just some advice that you'd like to gift?
Oh, I've got years worth of learnings racing through my head. How do I compact this into a good, meaningful statement for people?
It doesn't have to be one statement. You can ramble.
I think one of the biggest realizations I've had that has utterly and completely changed my life is forgiveness. And it's something I still struggle with. As we grow, right, whether it's over the years, whether it's over experiences, we learn how to be better. Hopefully, everybody learns how to be better. We learn better ways to do things. And for me, the biggest challenge to my practice is forgiving when I didn't know better. Mm. You were talking about the story about boiling the ants,
mm-hmm.
right? And it's, well, it seems abhorrent to you now and you'd never do it. It's also really important to forgive that you didn't know better then. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You were following the example of someone you loved and trusted, etc. And I'm finding, because it's still evolving, that's my challenge is, you know, I have a really big capacity for holding on to the badness, for holding on to, what's the word? And I can't think of a single, like, a word that applies, but it's, I often am too retrospective. I like to comb back through all of the things that I did wrong, all of the pets I didn't take care of properly, all of the relationships that fell apart because I was horrid in them. And I feel this desire to go back and correct it all. Well, first of all, you can't. So for anyone listening, if you have that same desire, learn to put it away. You can't go back and correct the past. It's impossible. And I know there's going to be people thinking, oh, but I can, because if I go and explain, it'll repair, etc. Right? You have this whole line of thinking that says, but I can. You can't. It's the past. It's done. The only way to grow is to look forward. I have a tattoo on my left shoulder, and it's an Ndrinka word, Sankofa. So it's African. And the embodiment of the word means go back and get it. And the image that comes with that word, because it's very much a pictograph before it was ever an actual lettered word, means that you cannot be successful if you do not take the lessons of the past. And that doesn't mean staying in the past, focusing on it, or correcting it. It says take the lessons from the past. Yeah. Right? So as your practice grows, as you learn how to be mindful, as you learn how to be kind and curious, as you discover this really amazing sense of self that will come with opening your mind, you have to let go of what's holding you back. And what's holding you back is staying behind yourself. I've found that I've made the biggest progressions by far when I've just forgiven me. I didn't know. I hadn't learned. I was impacted by. I was in this situation, right? There's a million ways to accept that realization that you need to forgive. Take the lesson, right? Take the, I'll never boil ants again. I'll never lie to a partner again. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Take those lessons, but forgive and look forward. That's truly the only way you're going to grow. You think about everything around us, everything that exists on this planet we live on, everything moves forward, right? Mm-hmm. We've got lots of cycles, but the cycle never goes backwards. It always goes forward. So you have to forgive and you have to look ahead.
It's the basic principles of karma right there, which hugely misunderstood in the West. But basically that, and I always like the way that Pema puts it. And she says, karma means the future is unwritten. And you can take what happened before. And when she talks about regret, and generally the way that regret is taught in Buddhism is it's not about wanting to go back and change things. It's about going, that thing that I did before didn't work or was harmful or was not okay. And so I'm going to learn from that. And the only thing I can do is live right now in this moment. And if I want to change what tomorrow is going to look like, then I'm going to learn from those things where I didn't know better. And now I'm going to go, well, I do know better. So now I make the resolution to not do that thing.
Exactly.
Yeah. And then that's how karma works. It's consequences.
Yeah. Even if the consequences are only inside you, right? Yeah. The consequences inspire better.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's that whole interconnectedness piece. It's that being able to see the relationality between all things and saying that yeah, you are just one person, but that doesn't mean that you are also in a vacuum. Or as you said earlier, like at the very beginning, we're not siloed.
Yeah.
We think we are, but we're not. And not at all. Because we're not making those choices and forgiveness, I think that's a really good way to put it, actually, because I think that is when we really get stuck and holding on to like things that we messed up or how things were in the past. It is really from a place of not being willing to forgive ourselves for our own humanity. Yeah. Like, oh, I'm human.
Yeah.
Right.
Because we're taught to be other, right?
Mm-hmm.
What's held in front of us is staged, scripted, airbrushed, etc. And so we don't allow ourselves to just, like you said, be human. Be human and have an experience and let the experience be bad and fail. And bad only in that it wasn't what you expected. There is no bad. Anyways, that's going to spark a whole other conversation.
This is great. We'll probably have to do another episode in the future. Thank you so much.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you. It's kind of a cool privilege to be able to do this with you.
Thank you for listening to Everything is Workable. To find out more about what I do, visit CaitlinSCHatch.com, where you can sign up to get my monthly wrap-up email, see my artwork, and read my blog. Heads up, I'm on the lookout for a social justice sound engineer who might be interested in collaborating with me on this show. There are more details about that on my site as well. Thank you to Dexter Britton for composing the fantastic music accompanying this and the previous two seasons of Everything is Workable.